This week on the show, we tell you the story how SSH became the port number 22 and how that was assigned, including the original emails. Then Dr. Brian Callahan asks himself, can GCC use Clang as its assembler? And he made the experiment, and you will see how that works out. There's a new program, AuxRunner, a macOS QMU-based app for running AUX. Then we tell you a little bit about the Stab Week, which is interesting, using the Kensington SlimBlade Pro trackball with OpenBSD and how that works, or not, running Ninefront on an emulated SGI Indie via MAME, and more in this week's episode of BSD Now. BSD Now, episode 551, SSH port story, recorded on the 6th of March, 2024. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow. And we thank you in advance for that. Hello, we are your hosts, Benedikt Reuschling.
And Tom Jones.
Exactly. These are the ones that you get to hear this week, as much as you like. And we have...
Benedikt cued me there. He was like, go.
Yeah, yeah. If only we had video, right?
Yeah, just like last week. While I have a very nice microphone right next to me here, tapping it, any way to mount it is in a box somewhere, and I don't know where it is. I mean, I've not moved, but it's been a week for you, so...
Yeah,
think
but
about
Jason,
how time works that way.
Yeah. The timing with Jason is always he records from the future because he's already on the next day when we record. And Tom is in between places. So maybe he's in two places at once by the time you listen to this. Right? Schrodinger's Tom or something. Yeah.
I don't know. That was a lot. There was a lot, but my sound is bad, and we know it's bad. So if you write in and say the sound is bad, we're going to go fine. We knew going into it.
It will be better.
And we do appreciate the comments about sound, though.
Yeah,
it was nice.
Since we're using this new recording platform, people have been positively telling us that the at least my audio is better. So.
I was thinking about this, Benedikt, and maybe you were recording the wrong microphone sometimes. And so I heard your Rode podcaster, but the wrong microphone was going through, because I can't imagine this software is doing anything different to Audacity.
Yeah. I have this little switch here causing, removing background noises, but I don't press that. I just don't want to angry JT even more than I'm already doing.
He's like, don't do any more processing.
Let's go to SSH stories. There is a story of getting SSH port 22, and this is covered at ssh.com. So how did SSH port become 22? They ask themselves, and this is the story for it. It's a longer article, but we can, I guess, cover most of the interesting bits of it. The default SSH port is 22. No shit, Sherlock. Sorry. It is not a coincidence. This is a story of how it got that port. So in case you want to do a little quiz among your colleagues, then you can just brag with this little story or knowing where this came from. The story of getting SSH port 22. The author is here, who I don't know they were, but let's call it the SSH people. They wrote the initial version of SSH Secure Shell in spring 1995. It was a time when Telnet or FTP were widely used. Anyway, they designed SSH to replace both Telnet, port 23, and FTP on port 21. Port 22 was free. It was conveniently between the ports of Telnet and FTP. They figured having that port number might be one of those small things that would give some aura of credibility. But how could they get that port number? They had never allocated one, but they knew somebody who could allocate a port. I mean, personally, it's much easier to type rather than 21 or 23. Just type two times. Why wasn't that port taken already? Okay, but that's me. Okay, the basic process for port allocation was fairly simple at that time. Internet was smaller, and they were in the very early stages of the internet boom. Port numbers were allocated by IANA, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. At the time, that meant an esteemed internet pioneer called John Postel and Joyce K. Reynolds. Among other things, John had been the editor of such minor protocol standards like IP, which is RF-791, and ICMP, RF-792, and TCP, which is RFC-793. Some of you may have heard about them. Yeah, just in a side note. I mean, okay, to me, John felt outright scary, having authored all the main internet RFCs, right? Anyway, just before announcing SSH 1.0 in July 1994, they sent them an email to IANA, and they post the original message here with all the headers, writing, "Dear sir, I have written a program to securely log from one machine into another over an insecure network. It provides major improvements in security and functionality over existing Telnet and RLogin protocols and implementations. In particular, it prevents IP, DNS, and outing spoofing. Yeah, my plan is to distribute the software freely on the internet and to get it into as wide use as possible. I would like to get a registered privileged port number for the software. The number should preferably be in the range 1 to 255 so that it can be used in the WKS field in name servers. I'll enclose the draft RFC for the protocol below. The software has been in local use for several months and it's ready for publication except for the port number. If the port number assignment can be arranged in time, I'd like to publish the software already this week. I'm currently using port number 22 in the beta test. It would be great if this number could be used if it's currently shown as unassigned in the lists. The service name for the software is SSH for Secure Shell. Yours sincerely, Tatu Ilonen from Finland." Okay, the next day he had an email from Joyce waiting in his inbox. And that is short and sweet and says, "Tatu, we have assigned port number 22 to SSH with you as the point of contact. Joyce." There we were. The SSH port was 22. That mail is from July 10th, 1994. Okay. So they announced the final beta version in their beta testers at Helsinki University of Technology. At 5:23 p.m., they announced SSH 1.0.0 packages to their beta testers. And at 5:51 p.m. on July 12th, 1995, they sent an announcement about SSH, the secure shell, to the Cypherpunks, excellent, Cypherpunks at toad.com mailing list. They also posted it to a few news groups, mailing lists, and directly to selected people who had discussed related topics on the internet. Okay, then they have a section about changing the SSH port in the server. By default, SSH server still runs in port 22. However, there are occasions when it is run in a different port. Testing use is one reason. Running multiple configurations on the same host is another. And no, it's not for securing SSH because everyone scans hosts and checks open ports, even if SSH is on port something other than 22. Okay, rarely it may also be run without root privileges, in which case it must be run in a non-privileged port, like port numbers that are greater than 1024. Port number can be configured by changing the port 22 directive in /d_config, which is an etc SSH directory. It can also be specified using the -p port option to SSHD. The SSH client and SFTP programs also support the lowercase p port option. So there you can specify the different number. Then they have a section about configuring SSH access through firewalls, but I guess that's pretty much IP table settings and other firewalls that you may have used. That's just establishing that port 22 is open. So there you have it. That's the story for port 22 and how it came to sit where it is still today. Cool.
Great. Next up, we have an article from Dr. Brian Robert Callahan on his blog, briancallahan.net. And Brian is writing about GCC and Clang. Can GCC use Clang as its assembler? Brian writes, "There are, I think, two great open source compiler infrastructures, GCC and LLVM. They have been a great boon to all kinds of development, open source and closed source alike. Today we're going to create a bit of a Franken compiler toolchain. Once upon a time, the LLVM project had a plugin for GCC called Dragon Egg, which would cause GCC to use LLVM's optimizers and backend generators instead of GCC's. We will do something not quite as cool, but something with potentially useful results. As a consequence of LLVM containing an integrated assembler, this means that Clang can assemble assembly files if you pass them to Clang. GCC cannot do this, at least not directly. If you pass GCC an assembly file, it will simply pass it onto your assembler, usually GNU AS. But can be another Unix assembler, such as the Sun assembler, which can run on Solaris and a Lumos. And so I wanted to know if it is possible to replace GNU.AS with Clang as the assembler in the GCC toolchain. There is potential to want this, at least on some systems, FreeBSD, specifically FreeBSD 14 release, where we'll be running our experiments today, no longer ships user bin AS binary. With LVM providing a linker and with many other utilities found in GNU bin utils, could GCC become a boutique frontend for the LVM system? Let's find out. The plan is to have GCC complete a full three-stage bootstrap of itself, with Clang specified as the assembler. That feels like enough of a real-world test that if GCC can compile itself, there will be a lot of code it can compile. The version of Clang found in FreeBSD 14 release is 16.06. The package you get if you run package install GCC is GCC 12. I think I'd prefer GCC 13 as it's the most recent. First, it is simply worth it to see if anyone else has already done this, thought of this, and made our advice life very easy. I did install GCC 12 with package install GCC. This GCC looks for its assembler at user local bin AS, which is where the bin utils package installs itself. Since I'm going to be deleting this install of bin utils anyway during our test, I simply copied user bin CC to user bin user local bin AS. GCC has a dash pipe flag which pipes the output from GCC into the assembler. Without this flag, GCC will write assembly code to a temporary file, then have the assembler read in that file. Clang supports this flag but does not actually do anything with it, as Clang generates object code directly without the need for an assembler. Unfortunately, this simple setup does not work. Clang complains you need the dash X flag to tell Clang where the input is if the input is on standard in. This means we'll need to write a small wrapper that adds this flag before executing Clang. I suppose this could be done in shell or an awk. You could do it in awk. But I wrote a quick prototype in D to add the necessary dash X assembler and dash C flags to effectively turn Clang into a command line assembler. It was a D program. A quick compile with LDC 2-0-release, and my wrapper program. Then I installed it as user bin AS. As FreeBSD 14 release does not ship with a user bin AS utility, we're not damaging anything by doing this. As an aside, D has become my language of choice for prototyping just about every new project. If you have never used D, you owe it yourself to download a compiler and try it. I used the tarballon patches from the GCC 13 port, but I built things outside the port infrastructure to make it easier on myself. I used all the same compiler flags as the ports build, except changing dash dash with AS and dash dash with LD flags to dash dash with AS as user bin AS and with LD as user bin LD. We are able to build the stage one compiler, but it fails right away with a message that the assembler does not understand dash dash 64. Interesting that while GCC and Clang use dash M64 and dash M32 to set the arch, GNU AES uses dash dash 64 and dash dash 32. In any event, I needed to find a way to convert the dash dash 64 and 32 flags into M64 and M32, as they needed to provide flags that Clang understands. Fortunately, it's really easy to add this functionality to our wrapper program. Now we can restart the build. We should not need to rebuild the stage one compiler, as it was built with Clang. Second failure. The stage one compiler got a few lines further in the build script and failed again. We were told, cannot compute suffix of object file, cannot compile, see build.log. And the issue is dot section eh frame prog bits. I'm not sure if this is a bug in Clang or a bug in GCC. In any event, the code does not error out when GNU AS is the assembler. I eventually traced the error to this discussion, which led me to this commit. In the web, these are much more helpful sentence than in a podcast. Perhaps Clang is being too restrictive as to changes in section flags, or maybe GCC should not be emitting those directives. I will need to build a new Clang in any event. Instead of rebuilding the base system's Clang, I chose to build the LVM16 port with an added patch to remove the offending check. It may seem heavy-handed as we're disabling all checks, but we are only going for proof of concept here. I'll leave it to the LVM people to determine if this is a bug or not. I built and installed this new Clang through the ports infrastructure, modifying our wrapper program to use the new Clang. Another build and install later when we're ready to continue. Like last time, we just need to restart the GCC build. we don't need to start all over as the stage one compiler is built with client. There's also an LLVM MC utility installed at the port. This utility appears to be an analog to GNU AS, but FreeBSD does not ship this utility in base, and Clang does have the integrated assembly built in, so I'm going to stick with Clang. And then we get a linker failure, a big linker failure. Searching around for this, I came across a blog post from one of the LLD authors, which states, GNU linkers give .gnu.link1 sections com.dat section semantics, ld.lld, simply ignores such sections. There's a bug that tracks when this hack can be removed. I will take this error to mean the issue has not been resolved. That means we will need to change our configure options for GCC and change --withld to --withld user local bin ld and install the bin utils packages so that we can use the GNU ld like the GCC 13 port does. We also need to restart our GCC builds from scratch yet again. You could use LLD without issue if you added --disable multilib flag to configure. However, I want multilib so I can test our assembler as much as possible. Things were going well until we got into our stage 2, libcpp, and we encountered a confusing error message. Type def __pointer diff type. Multiple definition. Does not declare anything. This one was a bit tricky to hunt down. It looks like GCC does not know that FreeBSD has a sys-types.h header, which of course it does. The actual definition of pointer diff t is found in sys __types.h, which sys/types.h pulls in. But that's a symptom of the actual problem. GCC does not think FreeBSD has ANSI C headers because that check fails. And this causes a cascading effect that eventually leads to the error we saw. I believe this means that GCC is unable to automatically detect if we have thread local storage, which we do, and we can force GCC to use it even if it fails to auto-detect it properly. We will need to start the build over, adding the --enable TLS configure flag to do that. I'm not sure why GCC is unable to automatically detect if we have TLS using Clang as the assembler. It is able to do it with GNU AS as used to the assembler, so there must be something subtly different between the two. This time, the build went all the way to the end and was successful. While we have some kinks to work out, getting the entirety of GCC compiled suggests that Clang is a potential powerful replacement for GNU AS, that, while not identical, is good enough to be an assembler for GCC. This should not be too surprising, as the LLVM integrated assembler should be able to assemble any arbitrary code, as you cannot know ahead of time what code you might be given to Clang. I discovered that Clang is missing an important feature. When GCC uses --pipe flag, it does not issue a hyphen for standard into the assembler. GNU AS, if you omit an input file, assumes everything will come from standard in. Unfortunately, Clang does not do this, as you cannot compile anything when using the --pipe flag. So you cannot compile anything when using the --pipe flag. I look to see what LLVM MC utility does, and it behaves the same as GNU AS, so we needed to switch to LLVM MC as our assembler. But that has its own quirks. Different flags to control 32 versus 64-bit, no -v flag. When GNU AS receives -3, it prints a line of self-identification, then continues on assembling whatever you give it. LLVM MC does not have this flag, giving it a --version or --version causes it to emit self-identification and immediately quit. It would be nice if LLVM MC emulated this. And with an update to the wrapper program, one last build and install later, and we have a rebuild of GCC just to be on the safe side. And all is good. We can now use --pipe flag and things work as they should. I doubt many compilers with a -WA flag would work well, but I've never seen any use of WA in the wild. To answer our question, yes, it is possible to use Clang as an assembler for GCC, though technically LLVM MC might be better. Is it useful? Your mileage may vary. I could imagine bringing up a new platform with LLVM and then wanting an ADA or Fortran compiler, but not wanting to port both GCC and bin utils. On the other hand, LLVM is growing a Fortran compiler, so maybe somebody wants to grow an ADA compiler for LLVM. I wonder what changes would be needed to smooth over differences we encounter during our experimentation, or perhaps LLVM MC utility can be improved or accompanied with a wrapper utility that emulates GNU AS. That would bring things very close to having a GCC be a boutique front end for LLVM systems, which I think for one would be really cool.
Right. Yeah. It's just the engineering behind this is just awesome, and he keeps doing this for various languages and compilers, so definitely hat tip to that. Okay, our next story is about the AUX Runner, and this is in the news roundup. So, what is AUX Runner? It's a macOS QEMU-based app for running A/UX. So there's a zip file, and that contains a standalone app based on QEMU that runs Apple's A/UX operating system. They built the A/UX setup using a guide that's separately linked from the article, and with extensive essential help from cat_7 in this thread at emaculation.com. Oh, nice way. Emaculation.com. Yeah, that's a forum there, link there. And that has been updated on the 20th of December 2023. To use it, simply launch the app. If you hold down the Option key while launching it, that's on the Mac, it will offer to open the command file inside it and also open a Finder window on the folder that contains the files. You can FTP to the A/UX system by starting an FTP section from the host system, set the FTP address as the same network address used by the Mac computer host, and set the username and password to user and password. And very important, set the port to 2121, not 21. So 2x21. And when you shut down A/UX from the A/UX menu, do not shut down QEMU until the Safe to Shut Down message appears. At this point, depending on the QEMU version that is running, you may need to press Control Option G, lowercase g, to release the mouse, and then Command Q, capital Q, to quit QEMU. Or it may be enough to press Command Q without releasing the mouse. By default, the app opens to the root account, which has no password. The documentation, which is linked below, explains how to log into the menu that asks for a username and password, and to log into different kinds of sessions. The setup supplied there has a root account and a user account named user with the password. You guessed it, password. The root account is empty, or the root password. If the app won't start. If the app doesn't start on your system, do the following. Open a terminal, type the string into the terminal window. So sudo xattr-rc and followed by a space. That space is essential, otherwise it won't work. So sudo xattr-rc space. Then drag the app into the terminal window so that its path appears on the command line. Press return to run the command. The app should now start. To display two windows, an alternative version of QEMU included in the app opens two windows, not just one. To enable this, change the name of the app so that it includes the string screens, like auxrunner-screens. The same AUX system will open, but on two screens. So you can make this the default setting by editing the Apple script. If you know how to edit Apple script, this will be easy. And they list some extra documentation from Apple directly. Basic skills, roadmap to A/UX, and a server administration. This is on Mendelssohn.org. Interesting.
What a wonderful thing. Okay, next we have the greatest named FreeBSD thing since I've renamed FStab. This is an email to the FreeBSD current mailing list from Gleb Shmurnov, FreeBSD developer. Hi, FreeBSD current users. Back in November, I came up with a proposal of providing some stabilization cadence to the development of the main branch known as FreeBSD Current. Here is a video with the initial proposal and discussion following at the Vendor BSD conference. It's a YouTube video. And here goes an up-to-date version of the plan. In the last decade, quality of FreeBSD Current improved so much that not only have Brave developers run it on their laptops, but also large companies use it. Time to bring it to a new level. Every individual or a business that uses Current on their own protocol for how to stay up to date and avoid disaster. An individual will first update their desktop and only after will update servers. A company could run their internal regression test suite or some other validation tool. Right now, all we have to do that independently from each other, having a little coordination, providing a little help to each other. But we also do not broadcast to the world that FreeBSD Current is usable. I've seen a lot of people who stay away from Current based on 20-year-old experience. Here's how we're going to improve. The last week of a month is declared stabilization week, stab week. Source committers are encouraged to push risky changes to FreeBSD main during this week. Source committers are encouraged to avoid pushing risky changes to FreeBSD main during this week. This is advice, not a policy. If a committer breaks something during this week, then they get 3x the public shame, but no administrative penalties are fined. And they get stabbed. No, nobody's getting stabbed. I'm sorry. Content warning violence. Committers are encouraged to push bug fixes, improve unit tests, clean up comments, and improve documentation. It's also a good time to do merging of past work to stable branches. Developers, of course, will continue to do work on bigger projects in their private branches. Side note, there is no agreement in the world as to what the last day, last week of the month is. For our purposes, we will use the week that contains the last Friday of the month because we want the monthly snapshot to be called by the name of the month, not the next month, unless we want the last day of stab week cycle to always be in that month. I've been saying stab week, but so far Gleb is not. But now, Monday of the stab week is the day to update your current and test it. On Monday, 8 a.m. GMT? That's an odd choice. On Monday, 8 a.m. GMT, UTC, tag is created and published. Right now, it is published at my personal Git repo. Note that the tag points at a hash in the official repo, so there is no trust involved here. At Netflix, I'll be working on merging the tag revision into our tree, and I will hand off the resulting branch to our excellent testing team, DHW and Olivier, usually by the end of Monday PST time. Other companies and parties are encouraged to test the tag revision. Peter Holm may switch his Stress 2 to run the revision. You're encouraged to update your desktop or laptop. Of course, runs FreeBSD current. I didn't talk yesterday. A short-lived stabilization branch may be created. In case we discover regressions compared to the previous month's stab week, love the fork so much. We should have t-shirts made. Bug fixes to them will be committed on the short-lived branch. This branch may contain direct cherry picks. I'm going to skip this. The stab week quiet period ends no later than Friday, 1800 GMT. No matter if we're able to identify and fix any or all bugs, the quiet period ends. The publishing level for first committers breaking FreeBSD current goes back to the normal level. In a case we were not able to address all the issues by the end of Friday, the stab week branch will act as an active, will be active past the end of stab week as we want to collect all regression fixes in the branch. But this is the worst case scenario. A more appreciated scenario is that the stabilization period ends earlier in the week if all testing parties report their satisfaction with the state of main, as is, or the stab week or the stab week branch. And if they don't see any fresh bug reports in Bugzilla or submissions via other channels, there's no reason to withhold commitment pushing their dangerous stuff. At the end of the stabilization period, be it Friday or earlier, I'll write an email to current at reporting results. Were there any regressions identified with the Monday tag? What has been accumulated in the stab week branch? Known stable points of FreeBSD main during the period recommended for use. The free riders who did not participate in the testing are now welcome to update their machines to publish stable points. More seriously, I actually hope in some future snapshots of FreeBSD will build using these. P.S. The February 2024 stab week was run internally without sharing publicly, and in a few minutes, the results will come. And for those, you will have to find them on the mailing list, because I don't have them.
So t-shirt would go, I survived stab week, and the only thing I got was this lousy t-shirt?
I feel like as a form of public shame, we would get some very hideous t-shirts made up for people that broke it so they could have them at conferences. We could also then auction off the t-shirt of shame at a conference of your choice. There's so many options. And of these, yeah. Sure, we won't do any, but they're just ideas and you can have them. They're free. Yeah. We paid
the general
for
idea
them.
Is good that we want to have more stabilization.
Stab week is great.
Yeah.
I have this like half written blog post, and by that I mean a rough idea where I want to explore occasional CI, mostly because I think it's really funny. But if I look in my notebook for planned ideas, I've got a lot of very vague terms that I have to look up, and they really don't tie anything to. If anyone could remind me what Resident Ghost referred to, I'd really like to know, because I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? So yeah, knife murderers, keep your knives in. This is not the stab week you're looking for. And so let's move into
No. Before we move on. Hmm?
We just keep making jokes.
So the last Friday of the month. Damn, the 15th of March is a Friday. The 15th of March is never going to be the last Friday of the month. It'd be great to have stab week end on the Ides of March.
That would be something.
Yeah, well, it was never going to happen. Might maybe the Ides of a different month.
Yeah. The Italians won't participate. Reasons. Here we go. No, it's good concept. We like it, and we want to have more of that, of the stabilization, that is. Okay, let's move on to the Kensington Slimblade Pro Trackball with OpenBSD. On the blog post, that let's try text-to-speech here.
Tonfertig.
Yeah, that's how they pronounce it, because we can't. That's the blog, and it goes like this. Wait, one more time. The author of the blog called...
Tonfertig.
Remembered, his dad brought home a Logitech trackball years ago.
That's a German pronunciation of a French word.
Yeah. I have a couple of voices installed, but this is. I think I have a very British one as well. But
I don't think your mic is getting it though. Maybe. I mean, I guess I heard it, so your mic is getting it. But yeah, that was very Tonfertig.
Yeah.
That's very German.
Very bad. So they remembered that dad brought home Logitech trackball years ago and have not had bad memories of it. So as part of the recent desktop changes, they decided to try a trackball. Internet reviews seem to acknowledge the Kensington Slimblade Pro trackball is one of the best devices out there. So they decided to try it with their OpenBSD laptop. Spoiler alert, if that's just what you're looking for, it still works, but it sucks. Okay, the device. That's what they sum up here. It is a bit taller than the 6-rows Logitech MX keys and way bigger than the Logitech M590. That said, it's still 1 phalange smaller than the whole hand. It doesn't seem heavier than the M590. It is made of shiny plastic that reflects a lot during photos. Ah, yes, you can see the author. Okay, in the picture. Good. They're not sure if they like the shiny plastic. It really looks cheap to him. I'd like to have aluminium and or made plastic. It can be connected to the computer using Bluetooth or using a USB dongle. It has a physical lateral button that switches the pointer speed and resolution. I'm using level 2 on my 27-inch monitor. It's rechargeable using USB-C. The box comes with a USB-C to USB-A cable and a USB-C to USB-A adapter. So what works? I'm using OpenBSD, so no Bluetooth. Not that it matters to me anyway. Plug in the USB dongle, you get the following. So you get the detection of the Kensington Slimblade Pro that's correctly identified. And WSCons control lists the device and limited properties. Mouse 4.type equals USB. Yeah. And for mouse 4.reverse_scrolling equals 0. Since then, everything seems okay. The top left button triggers button 2. The top right button triggers button 4. The bottom right button triggers button 3. You're still following? The bottom right button triggers button 1. Moving the ball moves the cursor as expected. Rotating the ball horizontally clockwise triggers button 5. Rotating the ball horizontally anti-clockwise triggers button 4. Those movements scroll up and down pages in Firefox and the Xterm, for example. What doesn't work? The doc says you can click 2 buttons at a time to achieve alternate actions. On OpenBSD, it doesn't seem to trigger anything but 2 individual events. On Windows, you can install the Kensington software and configure 4 extra dual button clicks, so he guesses this is a software-only feature. They have not found an indicator of battery charging level. The feedback overall, they already admit their biases when it comes to hardware. Yeah, okay, that's fine. We like OpenBSD as well. Those will hit that device really bad. It is really noisy and badly tuned. I mean, they say the clicks are really loud, louder than the Logitech MX Master 3, and it sounds like plastic echoing in the bathroom, going tic-tac when buttons are going down and up. You remember those metal cricket clicker toys? Oh, yes. The wheel movement emits clicky sound too. It is not that loud, but after 3 pages scrolling on their Mastodon timeline, they yelled at the trackball to shut up. The ball is quite nice and precise when it comes to selecting a window or clicking a GUI button. It's a bit harder to select text in a web page or a terminal, but you may have to get used to it. They're afraid tiny precise movements for photo editing may be challenging. All in all, moving with the fingertips is a really nice sensation. If you don't bother the noise, this alone can justify using the device. The buttons seem or the buttons being in a different place, the fingers need to get used to it, but it's quite fast. They still get pasted text when the index forgot, or when their index forgets that the top right is button 2 here. Clicking on the thumb gets quite natural. So although they tend to keep it up to not click, clicking with the pinky is far too easy and needs training. Now, the worst thing is they've always been using this device for less than a day, and they feel pain in their wrist they never had before. In their particular case, it is all but ergonomic. Okay, yeah. Feels like they've kept their hand and forearm with an angle of 45 degrees for weeks. Even the big MX Master 3 doesn't lead to such an angle. The M590 is even lower. Last word, I'm getting this item returned. Okay, was worth a try.
Some people like them.
Yeah. Are you a trackball person?
No, I'm a mouse.
I'm the mouse, yeah, same here. I know it has benefits, but I'm typing on the keyboard most of the time anyway, so, and the rest is just trackpad.
Oh, I had an absolute nightmare. I had to run VMware for some reason, and as I have said, I am moving house. I have not packed on my testbed machines because I need them to work and move house. Yeah,
till the last minute.
But I need to set up VMware, and I mean, I have these machines. They dual boot FreeBSD and Ubuntu, so I can compare like Linux and FreeBSD. And I thought, okay, I'll just set this up. I did not realize that I would need a mouse to do this. And so the only options I had for setting up this computer was as a keyboard. The only unpacked keyboard I had lying around was a PS2 IBM Model M. Thankfully, my gaming computer has PS2 ports, dual mode ones. So that was fine.
Still.
But for like half a day while I was setting up VMware and trying to get it to do anything, because you have to configure it with text files and the GUI, and it's just madness. I don't know how people live like this.
Yeah.
No wonder they're going out of business. Yeah. But yeah, I was moving like the dongle for my wireless mouse between like the computer and my laptop. And my laptop is docked, so it's not like I could just use the it's just infuriating. And then I realized there's a PS3 controller on my desk. And so I plugged it in. The PS3 controller has a touchpad, which comes up on FreeBSD and Linux just as a touchpad. And so I'm using an IBM good. Model M and a PS3 controller to control this computer, and it works great. Just perfect.
To run virtual VMware.
Yeah, I hate VMware. I don't know why it exists. That's a great story. You know, VMware workstation, you're not able to set up networks. It's not an option.
That sounds like VirtualBox to me.
Yeah, it's VMware workstation. Yeah. You have to pay $200 a year to have networks.
To have networking? Oh, this is just
no, to have multiple extortion. Networks. So you can have like one network. So everything's in the same networks. I don't know how they do it. To get it to use the native VMX device drivers, you have to edit a text file, which is as maddening as when, if you want to change the theme in the Windows terminal, the new one, you have to edit a JSON file. I was like it's Windows.
Luckily I never went it's that Windows. Route.
Yeah. Terrible.
It's turning more into Unix over time, but
it's only in between taking the versions, bad stuff.
So we're safe on the Unix side, just laughing at them.
Oh, it's just
like we always did.
Honestly, if you're running VMware, try Beehive. It's so satisfying.
Why?
I just run a shell script and have virtual machines, and it's just fine. Okay, anyway, enough of my problems. We have a blog. It's on posixcafe.org. About the page says who's asking, so I don't know who's by. I'm not going to worry about it. And it is running 9Fron on an emulated SGI Indie via MAME. They write, I recently found that MAME supports running the SGI Indie while looking for ways to test some modifications I was making to the MIPS code in 9Fron. After a fair bit of elbow grease, Synap and I, mostly Synap, were able to get the old 9Fron Indie kernel, 9Fron Indie kernel booting and running within MAME. I thought I might as well document how we set things up here. As a word of warning, this will require some decent 9Fron infrastructure setup already and some familiarity with things like NDB. Additionally, this system is barely usable from a modern standard. This system is barely usable from modern standards, so its usefulness is limited. Baseline MAME Indie. The mainline MAME only gives the Indie 16 megabytes of RAM, which is a little bit tight. Thanks to some clever folks on the IRIX forums, I found a patch bumping this limit to the theoretical maximum, 256 megabytes. You can grab a pre-patch repo here. It's a link. It's a web page. Or if you're using a system with NIC flakes available, you can, I don't even know what this means, you can run a NICs command. Next, you'll need to grab the required firmware files, of which there's a link to get some get going. Some links may be dead, but Google searching of the required file name should be enough to get archive.org files. Next, you'll need to configure networking. MAME is a bit unique here and expects a TAP device named tap-mess-uid-0. Additionally, after running once, you'll need to modify MAME root config indy4610.config to make the EDLC device line like so. Then you'll likely need to modify the network and in emulation menu in MAME, which can be found by booting up the emulator, hitting source lock followed by screen lock followed by tab, then clicking on network settings and heading over to TUN tap network. This should only need to be done once, as it will change the interface line for EDLC. Unfortunately, the specific index seems to be OS specific. It's a real tap mess indeed. Nine front bits. Now for the fun bits. Setting up a nine front grid boot peeing this device. So first build the user space in kernel, cd user slash source, object type equals MIPS, make install, cd user source 9SGI, make install. Next, we need to configure the network booting. First, add lib ndb local line to the tune of ip equals ether equals sys indy dom indy.gen, so ff equals myff, other stuff. Then, assuming you have your IP TFTP running and MAME set up correctly, you can boot up the indy, click the button for maintenance mode, enter the pre-ROM shell and type boot p, which should then grab your kernel and boot right up. And then there's a screenshot. That sounds great and awful and great and just terrible. Everything all together at once.
In one screenshot, yeah. Okay, well, this brings us into the Beastie Bits this week. We have the first item, Huffman codes. How do they work? The author here, which is xkqr.org, I think. This is how they start off with this. This is how I spent my time at work the past couple of weeks, roughly. So reading 21%, writing tests 17%, meetings 13%. Oh, lucky. Debugging 10%, code review 8%, tool making 7%, launch 6%, Slack 5%, stand up 5%, programming 3%, documenting 2%. Corporate espionage through post-it notes. Tomorrow, you, a corporate spy, will be in the office across the street, and I want to signal that to you what I've been doing throughout the day. I will do so by putting up post-it notes on a window. I have three colors of post-its: red, yellow, and green. We have just three colors, so we cannot assign one color to each task. That would only let us communicate the three most common tasks. What if we use two colors? Still not quite there, since that only lets us communicate 3 to the power of 2, which is 9 different tasks. Naively, we might think we need 3 colors per task, resulting in the following codebook. So green, green, green is reading. Green, green, yellow is writing tests. Green, green, red is meetings. Green, yellow, green, debugging, and so on and so on. Now, if you look over at my window and you see this, green, green, red, green, green, red, green, green, yellow, green, yellow, yellow, green, green, green. This is not your next password. This is the Huffman code. You know that I first spent quite some time in meetings, 2 times green, green, and red, then worked on tests, green, green, yellow, reviewing code, green, yellow, yellow, and finally did some reading, green, green, green. But that was a long sequence of post-its. If my boss walks past, he will think this looks very suspicious and tear them down. Using this codebook, communicating N tasks will always take 3 N post-it notes. How can we approach creating a codebook that results in the shortest coded message on average to avoid rousing suspicion and saving some trees because of the post-it notes? Okay, Huffman codes are short on average. The key idea is that for a rare task like programming or documenting, we can afford to use a long code word. In fact, if it lets us use a short code word for something common like reading, we should be fine with needing more than 3 post-it notes to encode something rare like documentation. The Huffman code is an algorithm we can follow that generates an optimal codebook. So if you want to know more about this, I recommend you read the full blog post to understand the Huffman codes and what they are used for, not just to corporate post-it spying.
Next up in the Beastie Bits, we have an update from undeadly.org, the OpenBSD journal. This is contributed by Jana Johansson, and it comes from the Don't Pee on the Electric Fence department. And it is new code for SIGIL fonts help identify missed branches. If you run recent OpenBSD on certain AMD64 or ARCH64 platforms, indirect branching to an unexpected location will crash your program. In order to prevent ROP attacks and similar ways to have your program execute code where it shouldn't, the OpenBSD compiler will insert an extra instruction on all the places where a branch is supposed to land, and if it lands anywhere else, a CPU fault is raised and your program gets an illegal instruction. Previously, crashes of this kind have looked more or less any other kind of fault where code is executing random data or from random locations, but since the kernel knows when this has happened, we can make it explicit the fault is due to missing branch target instructions, which will help a lot with debugging. And there is a comment on here by Aspen. Previously, these just showed as the sigil illegal instruction, and they still do. But this commit changed things so that extra information is available when running under ktrace. 11th gen and newer Intel CPUs have this feature. Look for IBT in the CPU attach line and dmessage. Support was added for 7.4, but a recent change to stop doing retpylene by default means that more programs are likely to accidentally trigger the mechanism, primarily those with ASM code. If you have such hardware, it'll be helpful to update to a recent snapshot and packages to check if things still work for you. However, a couple of problems and common packages have only very recently been fixed, including fixed JPEG, graphics in lib2, and so at the moment you either want to update from that port if installed or wait until packages are available.
Then we have news from NetBSD, the 10.0.rc5 is out, so this is short and sweet, so they are soon giving their full release of 10.0 out. And we have a new Illumos Telegram channel that you probably want to join. Illumos and its distributions, this is t.me/IllumosDistroes, so R-O-E-S at the end. And the description is, Illumos is a Unix-like OS and it's based for several distributions. Its legacy goes all the way back to Bell Labs. When Oracle killed OpenSolaris, many core devs left Sun and Illumos rose from its ashes. So at the moment of the recording, they have 89 members and 15 of them are online. And I guess some of them have an overlap with the BSD Now Telegram channel, which has 125 members, as far as I can tell, last time I looked. So I guess there will be a good number of people being in both channels.
Okay, and then last up for this week, I think we should cover the EuroBSD CFP too. Last up for this week, we have the January-February issue of the FreeBSD Journal is here, celebrating 10 years in publication. The January-February 2024 issue marks the 10th anniversary of the FreeBSD Journal. Join us in commemorating this momentous event by checking out this exceptional issue dedicated to networking. You'll find a diverse array of articles covering topics such as RAC, SRIOV, Batman, TCP, and FreeBSD 14, and more. Finally, challenge yourself with the 10 years of FreeBSD Journal crossword puzzle crafted by Tom Jones. That's me. You'll notice we've moved away from our browser-based offering and now provide HTML versions alongside the traditional PDFs for each article. A full PDF version is available to those who prefer a magazine-style layout. I made a crossword. It might be really, really hard. I don't know. You will have to do it without cheating and tell me. Benedict cheated. So
yeah.
I just don't know.
Try that.
John almost did
it's
but he couldn't get one.
It's definitely full packed with cool, interesting articles. Mine is having a bug, which I found out. Oh, there's a typo in my name as well. just checking that out. But definitely check out the issue and the others before it and the ones that follow after it, because we are always hard at work making it a great issue every time. And this one is, again, the 10th anniversary, so we've been around for 10 years. I'm there only maybe half of the time of it. I wasn't there
from the
beginning.
I've been there half the time, so you must have been there longer than me.
You?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, it seems like yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Oh, well.
I get
old and I forget which years it is.
That's how they get you.
But yeah, definitely good to have these things. And also separate articles that you can get as PDFs if you want to read them on your PDF reader or online or on the go. So yes, check those out.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud. You can be sure that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what is duplicated. It then assembles the data into compressed blocks, encrypts them with your local private key, and this key never leaves your system. The data is then uploaded into the cloud. Even if someone is able to obtain your data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code and make sure it does what we say it does. Tarsnap has bug bounties so that if you find errors in the code, you can get paid for helping make the software better. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse not to have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
Okay, a final thing we would talk about in our podcast would be questions and feedback and such from listeners like you. And they would send these emails to feedback@bsdnow.tv, and we would all look at them, and eventually someone would add them to show notes, maybe, or even respond. JT responded to some this week, but I don't have any here to read. But we did get a piece of feedback last week from Misha Peters about the EuroBSDCon 2024 CFP being open. It's open now. It opened in the past for you, and it runs until the 15th of May, or until maybe a little bit later. Who knows? But you shouldn't wait. You should submit put an entry in now. You can update it. You're allowed to change what's there up to the deadline. You could ask the program committee for help if you'd like some help, but you should get something in there as soon as you can. Submit early, submit often. But yeah, I look forward to reading what your submissions are for a great conference in Dublin, Ireland. Ireland.
Oh, yes. Perfectly fine location. I've been there once, and I will be happy to return.
I'm in the Irish Sea.
Yes. Oh, don't forget to bring your passport if you're an EU citizen. So this is Schengen and not Schengen.
Not Schengen.
So yeah, but there's various ways to. They say that on the website that we should bring the passport. So I'm just reading what they say. Yeah, that's pretty much it for today. Thank you for listening. As always, let us know if you found the episode interesting or some things that you want to change to feedback@bsdnow.tv. We also have a Telegram channel, t.me/bsdnow, as mentioned. And if you want to support this show, check out Patreon. It's patreon.com/bsdnow.